Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. Hey, everyone. This is Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and this edition of the show is dedicated to all of our gay, lesbian, and bi listeners who are no doubt thrilled that they will soon be able to get married here in Australia, if that is what they want to do, thanks to the result in our plebiscite / postal survey thing here in Australia on same-sex marriage. It's been a really rough few months for LGBTI people here in Australia, as no campaigners have done their level best to make, gayness look like this creeping sinister thing that's going to make their kids wear the wrong clothes to school or something. I don't know. I don't really understand it. But it is over now. It is well and truly over. So a big sigh of relief for all of the people who, you know, this campaign has been affecting. So yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge that. Okay, so this week's show is a cracker. We'll be checking in with Mara Tam a little bit later on. She's telling us why the idea of a so-called Digital Geneva Convention is ridiculous. Then after that, Rich Smith of Duo Labs will be in the sponsor chair. You may have heard about some recent research Duo did into Apple EFI patches basically not working or not sticking. Rich walks us through that research, why Duo did it, how they did it, and what it can tell us. And yeah, it might be Mac research, but the real worry, as you'll hear, is around Wintel firmware updates. Duo Security is this week's sponsor. They are best known as a provider of multi-factor authentication software, but they've recently started adding a lot of host integrity checking technology into their products. They have a vision. They're really trying to be an enabler of Google's BeyondCorp initiative. You know, you can think of it that way, and they're building the tools to make that happen. I love Duo Security. So yeah, big thanks to them, and do stay tuned for that interview with Duo Labs Director of R&D, Rich Smith, coming up in a little while. But before all of that, of course, it is time to take a look back at what's been making news over the last week with Adam Boileau. Yeah, yeah. Freedom. And Adam, first up, this has been a bit of a slow burn over the last few weeks. Facebook has announced a pilot program designed to combat what most people would call revenge porn, but what they're terming non-consensual intimate images.
Yes, Facebook have suggested that in order to help them filter people posting your stolen nudes, that you should upload them to Facebook, and Facebook will store them, take a hash of it, not store them, I guess, which is one of the finer details that subsequently come out, and then use that to try and filter when people otherwise upload them, which, I mean, it's clearly not a mechanism that's ever going to be perfect, but you know, you can see why it's an idea they might have, that they've come up with, and it may in fact have some benefit. But yeah, there's been, I guess, some confused reporting about exactly how the system is going to work. One of the things that's broken, I guess, in the later half of the discussion about the story is that that material that you upload or you send to yourself and then submit to Facebook will actually be reviewed by a human, which is both good and bad. I mean, good in the sense that it stops this process being used to take down material, which, you know, is entirely unrelated to the problem they're trying to solve. But on the other hand, if you're trying to not be victimized, maybe that, you know, sharing it with an actual human somewhere feels like victimization.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a good example of a really hard problem.
Well, that's right. You know, there's no easy way to crack this one. And I think the design, the intention of the program, I believe, the primary idea behind it is so that they can flag images as they come through Messenger, because they already have some pretty sophisticated stuff designed to block, you know, pornographic images on the Facebook site itself. So this is to try to stop extortion scams through Messenger. It's not just a hash, by the way. We should point that out. It's a little bit more sophisticated than that. So if you change a pixel in this image, it's still going to get flagged. If you crop it, it's still going to get flagged. But, you know, this will not stop direct extortion via email. It won't stop someone emailing your nudes to your coworkers and, you know, family or whatever it is. But what I think is interesting about this is Facebook is taking a step here to create some sort of centralized database of these types of images. And of course, they're in an excellent position to verify that these images come from who they say they are because they've got your photos, right? What I'm imagining is as Facebook as a first point to authenticate that this image does in fact belong to this person, they don't want it out there. From there, I'd imagine that's data that they can share, these sort of image signatures. So maybe sites, some of the pornography sites like Pornhub or whatever would want to take that data and then use it to scrub their site of this sort of material because, you know, they might be smut peddlers, but even they have limits.
Yeah, and I think this is an approach that for child exploitation material we have seen kind of work, you know, where...
That's it. That's what I've been saying about this. I think the idea is to make this sort of material as toxic as child exploitation material so that there's easy ways to determine if you're inadvertently hosting it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that, you know, as you say, it's a very laudable goal. The challenges of doing it are, you know, not... not non-existent, but yeah, like building a centralized database that can be shared in the same way that child exploitation material hashes and you know whatever other signatures are shared, you know, does seem like a reasonable thing. And you could imagine, you know, sites like Imgur or you know other big image hosters taking this database and then yeah, using it, and we end up in an environment where it is actually much harder to do this. Although you know this is just the first step, and a lot of the criticisms we've seen really have been about, well, you could just post it to Reddit, right? Which you know, clearly that is the case right now, but yeah, as you say, maybe 5 years from now.
Well, I'd imagine if Reddit could get a hold of these signatures, you know, hey, problem gone, right? And of course, that's going to leave some sites as outliers who will continue to host material like this, but then it gets pretty easy to pick out the bad actors, right? This is stage one in what I feel is a much bigger objective, and I sort of feel like some of the criticism leveled at it hasn't been entirely fair because they're saying, well, it's not going to fix the problem. It's like, well, no, but it's a step down that path, right?
Yeah, and I think it's a really good example of, you know, the sorts of very, what Peter Goodman calls wicked problems we have in security, where there isn't a perfect solution and we end up thrashing about, arguing about how imperfect a solution is rather than doing something that solves 10% of the problem or 20% of the problem and maybe leads towards solving 50% of the problem, which, you know, something like this might aspire to.
Old mate Julian back in the news. Also, Adam, with a couple of stories here. WikiLeaks has begun releasing source code for, you know, CIA spying tools in the so-called Vault 8 dump. I mean, this is just sort of like the Vault 7 dump, isn't it? He's just dumping tooling because apparently there's a burning right for the public to know the source code details of CIA tooling.
Yeah, like it's kind of hard to argue that this is a super useful thing to do other than for drawing attention to WikiLeaks, which is clearly the reason for doing it. But yeah, like whether or not we're going to gain any particular insight, so far they haven't dropped source for any of the really kind of, you know, bits that might be more interesting, some of the command and control and other tooling. So far it's been relatively, you know, sort of innocuous sorts of things, I suppose. So far, it's things we're not going to learn a huge amount from the source. But yeah, it's just interesting, I guess, comparing the narrative from WikiLeaks when they originally dropped some of the data, you know, talking about, you know, not sharing information widely and talking to some of the vendors to deal with bugs and stuff, to now, like, let's just drop the source code because, you know, the news cycles got bored.
Yeah, they're just like, well, I don't know, here you go. It's some new stuff, right? They're not even trying anymore. Interestingly enough, too, I mean, look, I'd understand, you know, if WikiLeaks got binary samples and submitted them to, you know, AV companies, I would think that's kind of reasonable, you know, but like dropping the source code seems a little bit, a little bit motivated by less than pure intentions, it would seem. One thing that WikiLeaks was talking about through its Twitter account, we all know that's Julian, but one thing that they were pushing out through the WikiLeaks account was that the publication reveals the CIA wrote code to impersonate Kaspersky Labs AV. Now, this feels like a very deliberate disinformation attempt. They were indeed using a dummy certificate from Thought that claimed to be Kaspersky AV, but I'm guessing that's an anti-detection measure so it doesn't look weird on the wire, not a sincere attempt to try to have incident responders misattribute this to Kaspersky.
Yeah, like it doesn't seem realistic to suggest that this is actually related to, you know, fooling attribution. I mean, obviously, if you've got packet inspection on the wire that's looking at the metadata of encrypted comms, you're going to glance at the subject of the cert. You're probably not going to validate it. Certainly, the idea that your IPS would validate certs for sessions it's watching going past seems pretty improbable in most cases. So, yeah, I don't think that this as a attribution thing is likely. I mean, maybe they picked Kaspersky specifically to kind of thumb their nose at them, but yeah, I don't think you know, as an attribution tell. No, I don't buy that.
No, but I mean, it feels like WikiLeaks is trying to throw some shade at the criticisms of Kaspersky by various people in the US government, right? Like, it just feels like, oh, let's just muddy the waters and, you know, it was the deep state. Kaspersky is innocent. It sort of got that vibe to it. But
WikiLeaks Twitter feed has just gone like fully bonkers in the last couple of years, hasn't it? It's just full of that kind of nut job stuff.
Well, WikiLeaks Twitter account also at the center of some very significant news this week, which actually does have an InfoSec hook. Some direct messages between the WikiLeaks account and Donald Trump Jr.'s account in the lead up to the election last year. I mean, at first glance, it doesn't really look that interesting. It's about what you'd expect to see in a DM conversation between those two. I think Trump Jr. only sent three responses to Julian's messages. One of Julian's messages was suggesting that Team Trump lean on the Australian government to make him the ambassador to the United States, which is just like, this guy is disconnected from reality. I mean, even in 2013, farcical, you know? In 2013, the WikiLeaks party with Julian at the head of the ticket got like 0.66% of the vote, right? Like, he's never been popular here. So that's just, and you know, the government hates him. So that, you know, that's just not going to happen. But Donald Trump Jr. Being who he is, you know, has actually dumped all of these messages. And one in particular is pretty interesting, which is that WikiLeaks wrote to Donald Trump Jr. saying a PAC run anti-Trump site, PutinTrump.org, is about to launch. The PAC is a recycled pro-Iraq war PAC. We have guessed the password. It is Putin Trump. See about for who is behind it. Any comments? Now, two things come to mind. First of all, guessing the password and passing on the password to political opposition to, you know, someone like Donald Trump Jr., I'm guessing is a CFAA problem at the very least. You know, and this is now evidence, this direct message. And second of all, you would sort of expect that someone in Donald Trump Jr.'s position at that point maybe should have reached out to the FBI and said, hey, you know, we're getting DM'd creds from WikiLeaks. Because, of course, this exchange came after public claims about WikiLeaks' involvement with Russia and involvement in the DNC stuff.
Yeah, like, it just, nothing good comes out of that, and much more so for WikiLeaks than necessary for Donald Trump Jr. in this particular case. But yeah, like, that's just kind of, you know, it doesn't matter that the password is rubbish, you know, if you're going around guessing people's passwords. Yeah, that's kind of hacking.
It's rubbish hacking, but it is hacking.
It's rubbish hacking, but it's hacking nevertheless.
I mean, I keep thinking of the Matthew Keyes situation where he took one of his employer's passwords. I think it was the LA Times, wasn't it? And then he dumped it into an IRC channel, an anonymous IRC channel, and said, go f*** it up. You know, it's basically the same thing, but at a higher level.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right.
Meanwhile, the New York Times has a pretty comprehensive write-up on the shadow brokers, or the shadow bears, as some have taken to calling them, which really shows us that the US intelligence community still really doesn't know quite what's happened there. But my money's still on a compromise of Hal Martin's home network, but it's a good piece.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a good write-up. Kind of covers some of the backstory, and also, I mean, has talked to a bunch of people who worked at the NSA and specifically in the TAO, and, you know, got some insights as to kind of what the impact of Snowden and then the shadow brokers was on, you know, on morale, and then the response that the NSA has had, you know, in trying to figure out who is leaking, if it's a leaker, or who's broken in, if it's an external attacker, you know, the effect that that's had on morale of people who are there, you know, trying to serve their country, and, you know, are now caught up in a witch hunt, you know, looking for how all of the stuff's been leaked. So, you know, it's a really solid write-up of the impact, you know, I guess that we on the outside assumed occurred inside the NSA. And this has been, you know, the story's been put together with people who were actually on the inside of it. So, yeah, it's a good, you know, a good write-up of the turmoil that this has caused.
I had an interesting discussion with someone about this piece, actually. And, you know, all of this material that shadow brokers have been releasing is 2013 and prior. And there's an interesting data point that I didn't think of, which is after Snowden walked out, they really tightened stuff up, right? So that might explain why this stuff was only available until, you know, why they were only able to get stuff until 2013.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a reasonable conclusion to draw from, you know, what we know of the timeline, that might have...
Maybe they put some araldite into the USB ports on the computers or something.
Yeah, I mean, or just, you know, just enough to spook, if it was an insider doing it, spook the insider, or if it was a, you know, an outside attacker, maybe they've had to lay low for a while, they've lost access to their implants, although you'd imagine that, you know, if you were already in, then that would be that, but... Yeah, no, that's there's also the story does kind of touch on whether it was purely Hal Martin or whether there is, in fact, you know, a third or a fourth
But the story sort of makes it clear they have no idea. They're just going on a polygraph binge, and they've got no idea, and they've just sort of fallen into this paranoia vortex. You know, I mean, that's why I found the story so interesting.
Yeah, and I cannot imagine that it is a particularly fun place to work at the moment with all of that going on. And yeah, the fact that they don't know, despite the shadow brokers dumping this stuff on the internet for what, like a year now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad.
People are leaving, and they're taking a pay rise, and they're having coffee breaks in this morning instead of polygraph breaks. And it's, yeah, you could sort of understand why that would be a preferable scenario. Ars Technica is casting doubt on some claims that some people were able to fool Apple's Face ID with like a $150 rubber mask.
Yeah, obviously we saw the story, was it last week, about Wired's attempt to try and bypass the sensor. This crew from Vietnam, who've done some previous work with bypassing face identification stuff through webcams on laptops, have put out this research demonstrating their technique, or like I'm mostly demonstrating, but not quite showing all the necessary parts. So Ars has been, I think Dan Gooden at Ars has been kind of following up, trying to get some answers from them about some specific bits, and it's been a little bit vague. So we don't really know whether their technique has done exactly what they say, or exactly how they managed to create the, like, for example, some doubt cast on the silicon rubber nose that they made, and exactly how, by what method they trained the phone and how they obtained the data to make the nose and that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a few unknown bits, but yeah, it's you know, I guess it's not a surprise that, you know, people have been giving it a go. I mean, the, you know, Apple's.
I just find it funny that it's turned into such a big deal when really faking a fingerprint with a, you know, the right chemicals and some gummy bears isn't too hard. You know, and everyone's like flipping out because, you know, if you spend a whole couple of days making up a rubber mask, you might be able to bypass it. Like, who cares?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. From a larger, you know, kind of threat model point of view, it's not a super exciting thing. But yeah, it's kind of futuristic and sci-fi.
Yeah,
and I think,
yeah.
It's, you know, it's movie hacking stuff, and everyone loves that. You know, the old Mission Impossible rubber mask on the face stuff. Everyone loves that sort of thing.
So, that's right. You know,
let them have their fun, Pat.
And I would have got away with it if it weren't for you meddling kids. Now, over the last few years, we've been covering the story of Mark Karpeles, who's the former CEO of Mt. Gox, the Bitcoin exchange. He's wound up on trial, I believe, in Japan over the collapse of that exchange. Interesting story here from Ars, which is pointing out that if he does have to pay back certain people, he'll be paying them back as per Bitcoin's value in 2014 at $440 per Bitcoin, rather than the current value of around, you know, $6,500. So he could walk away with lots of money.
Yeah, and that certainly does strike you as somewhat unfair. I mean, I imagine if you had Bitcoins lost in Mt. Gox, that you would be pretty upset about the idea that he's going to walk away with $600 million worth of Bitcoin, even after paying everybody out the full value of, you know, what was in Mt. Gox at the time, which, yeah, it, you know, just, you know, offends natural justice, I think. But yeah, the apparently that's the way it works, right? When the bankruptcy happened in 2014 and they were, you know, valued in yen at the time of the bankruptcy, and, you know, the fact that it's now worth, what, the 200,000 Bitcoins they found subsequently are now worth, you know, $1 billion. Tough. So yeah, it'd be funny to see how this one works out. There's some angry, you know, quote investors, unquote, in Mt. Gox that are, you know, agitating to try and get their money. But yeah, we'll see. Good luck with that, I think.
Yeah.
They're only going to blow it on, you know, Ethereum ICOs anyway. So maybe, I don't know, maybe don't go after your money. You're only going to lose it.
The abuse of Android's accessibility services is so rife that Google has now started cracking down and removing apps that use it. And they've written up some really strict guidance on how those features can be used. This is interesting.
Yeah, we've seen this used for a bunch of kind of screen scrapery and app automation and, you know, injection by malware and kind of things. So, it's, yeah, it's long been a feature that has been abused. Google's now requiring developers to explain to them exactly how the accessibility services in their apps are used for actual accessibility functions. And if not, they're going to have the apps pulled out of the Play Store in a month, which, yeah, I think if you're an app developer and you've got a whole bunch of rubbish apps on their Play Store, you know, that's going to be probably quite a burden to go through. You don't want to have all your apps delisted quite so fast. But yeah, I think it's a good move. I mean, Google has to do something about some of the problems it's got, and this is one that it can do more easily than some of the other problems. So, you know, it seems like a good step.
Meanwhile, the Chinese smartphone manufacturer OnePlus shipped their device. This is quite a popular phone. They shipped their device and they forgot to remove the Qualcomm like engineer mode app from the device, which is less than ideal.
Yeah, and this app has like a privileged activity that it can perform on the phone. Basically, it lets you escalate privilege and run commands as root. Clearly not desirable, and yeah, it means that anyone who runs an app on their phone can get owned. So yeah, not particularly smart.
Islamic State having a hard time all round at the moment, losing basically all of its territory and just, you know, just generally having a bad time, which is awesome. But they're also having a bit of a bad time on the internet.
Yeah, they had a mailing list and they had some security issues with it in the past and eventually decided that they had secured the stuff and taunted that they could now handle email attacks or any type of hack. A bunch of other Sunni Muslim hackers took issue with this, owned them and dumped a full list of subscribers from their email list.
I'm guessing like 95% of their subscriber list was journalists.
Probably, yeah, journalists and, you know, CIA.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how dumb you'd have to be to actually subscribe to an ISIS mailing list, but whatever, they got owned. It's funny. Let's move on. A story kicking around the last couple of weeks as well is about an AI bot, which is designed to mess with email scammers just to soak up their time, and apparently it works pretty well. There's a video here and everything.
Yeah, this is actually from a New Zealand not-profit called NetSafe that handles sort of, you know, consumer internet safety stuff, you know, cyberbullying and scams and that kind of thing. And yeah, it's like it's part marketing, part performance art, part actual kind of scam baiting. And I think, you know, it'll have more effect in warning people about the dangers of being phished than it will necessarily tie up the time of spammers. But yeah, you send spam emails to it that you've received, and it will then go on and engage in chatbot driven email conversation, with the the average Nigerian 419er or whatever, and tie up their time. And the idea is, you do this enough, then you'll make it uneconomical in terms of time for the attacker, which is
it's like a human proof of work, right? You're just raising the cost, the time cost. And I think, it's a bit of a gimmick now, but can you imagine if Google, for example, applied this to Gmail at scale?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of tar-pitting stuff is not without its useful approaches, useful benefits, eh? And you're right, like at scale, you could see this kind of thing working. But yeah, I think, mostly it's just really nicely done, like in their package and their videos and the way they promoted it. It's just all really slick. So good work, NetSafe.
Comedy bug of the week, Huddle. This is some sort of document sharing thing, online collaboration, something that I don't really know much about, but they had a funny bug and we should laugh at it.
Yeah, and in this particular case, the reason this is super funny is because the BBC owned it. Like they were using it, one of their staff members was using it, went to log in to share files with some other BBC staffer and got logged into KPMG's account, which, it's one thing to get hacked by hackers. It's another thing, the whole thing, to get hacked by accident by journos. So, yeah, not so great.
Please tell us the mechanics of the bug because it is hilarious.
So apparently when you logged into this thing, there was like a it gives you a token after you log in, and that token was generated based on time, and it turned out that if you logged in within like 20 milliseconds of somebody else, you got the same token, and it was kind of random as to whose account you got. So yeah, that's just what a rubbish bug.
Yeah. I mean, how does that even happen, I guess, well, yeah, time-based code generation that's not flipping over quickly enough, but still, that's just so dumb.
It is pretty dumb, but it's not a super uncommon bug class. I mean, that kind of concurrency timing stuff, like, we do see it relatively often in our day-to-day business, doing web pen testing and things. But if you're offering a secure online collaboration service, and secure is kind of your thing, maybe get it tested properly. I don't know. I'm just going to suggest that.
Microsoft has issued some guidance for people out there who are concerned about this dynamic data exchange, or DDE, bug that has made so many headlines over the last month or so.
Yeah, I mean, essentially Microsoft's position here is that it's a feature and they're not going to fix it. But what they have done is provided some registry keys for administrators to use to disable this functionality. Immediately alongside that, of course, is the warning that if you actually use this for legit business purposes, then your business might explode. People do use DDE a lot in Excel to import data from other sources, which is the legit, point of the feature. And if you just blindly turn it off as a sysadmin, you might break the Excel spreadsheet that runs your entire global enterprise. So, a little bit careful with that one. But Microsoft is just stuck with this. Like, they can't get rid of it. the best they can do is give people tools to deal with it in their environment and hope it doesn't go horribly wrong.
Back to Dan Gooden at Ars Technica, and he's written up some research into how attackers can actually leverage AV. This is it's kind of fun hacks, right? Kind of reminds me of some of Billy Rios's stuff from like 10 years ago on, blending bugs, like actually, just getting files onto the disk and then using other bugs to move them around and stuff and, chain for the win.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a really good kind of classic, use of a number of different components for things they weren't intended for. And the fact that it's an AV, of course, makes it a funnier story. This particular bug is like a local privilege on Windows where basically you abuse the antivirus program's privileged position to move files around for you. So you take your payload, you trigger the AV to quarantine it, and then you use the user's ability to unquarantine it onto a place where you've pre-created the file system, like junction point, to have it write into another directory or remove a DLL that's not from a trusted place and move it other ways. You can override it with your one. And then from there, get code exec as a privileged user, which, yeah, it's kind of a neat, a neat stunt hack. The guy who found it apparently has been using it on, pen test engagements and stuff for Privesk. So, yeah, nice technique, good write-up. Pity about having to put a name on the bug, but we don't talk about bug names anymore, so we won't discuss that.
There we go. Now, someone's developed a nice little cryptocurrency miner that will run in people's browsers, and looks like they've owned like 2,500 websites and just sort of injected it into those websites. So, nice little scam, I guess. I don't know how efficient it is to mine cryptocurrency in a browser.
Well, yeah, I think the thing here is that it's amazing it's taken this long for it to be happening at scale. I mean, once people started adding WebGL support to browsers for having graphics cards acceleration, we thought we were going to see WebGL-based mining, and we really didn't. This is just on CPU using JavaScript, so yeah, not super efficient. But it's been facilitated by this company called CoinHive that basically provide this as a service so that you can, instead of having ads on your site, have your users pay to view your site by mining cryptocurrency, which is clearly a rubbish idea. And the only valid use is, scamming people by owning other people's sites and then, dropping this JavaScript on other
which
people's
is
websites.
Exactly which is what's exactly happening,
what's
right?
Happening. Yes.
CyberScoop, this is a really interesting story. A stolen iPhone is only of so much use to a criminal, right? Because they're trackable and whatever, and mostly they get broken down and sold for parts. Some crooks have figured out that they can send phishing emails to the theft victims pretending to be a representative from Apple, and that way they can phish their Apple, what do they call it, iCloud credentials, and then, unlock the phone and away they go, right? So that's an interesting 1-2 step, isn't it? Because quite often with these phones, there's the I've been stolen screen, which might have the user's email address on it.
Yeah, no, I think it's, it's a sign of the times that we've, we're seeing this escalate from a combination of physical and now, phishing and stuff. And actually, people are selling software tools for doing this. There's a couple of them floating around the underground that actually automate this process, like have template phishing emails for, Apple ID and that kind of thing, and manage, all of the campaigns for you and that kind of thing, and presumably have support and extra, customer service features like that. Being able to actually turn this into a thing that Common Garden, criminals could actually do to increase the value of their stolen things. Well, yeah, I guess that's the free market in action or something, isn't it?
Bleeping Computer reports that someone's having an awful lot of fun with the script kiddies.
Yeah, this one's like good comedy hacks from old school hacker forum times. Somebody's been distributing like a IoT scanner that's backdoored to own your box, which of course, if you grew up as a hacker kid in the 90s, every script you got off the internet was backdoored to own your box. If you were lucky at work, yeah. If you were unlucky, it would RMRF your box. But yes, I guess this is a reminder to everybody to always read all of the shellcode, or in this case, all of the, gzip-based 64 PHP in your hacker scripts before you run them.
Yes. Oh, now, we love ICOs, Adam. We think they're hot, hot, hot. And boy, have I got a pitch for you. The Security Plus Cloud initial Cybercoin offering registered on an Australian domain. I have never seen such an obvious scam in my life.
Yeah. So, I mean, their putative business model is like threat intelligence in the cloud with Bitcoin and machine learning and anything else we can, you know, kind of copy paste out of Wikipedia that makes it sound awesome and amazing and so much growth. Oh my God, the growth. It's going to be amazing. We're going to open security operations centers and yeah, like absolute scam. I hope that no one who listens to the show would be silly enough to fall for such a scam, but yeah, wow.
Well, just, I mean, I know that there's people from vendors listening. So Trend Micro, TrapX, Tenable, Imperva, Intel, IronKey, Firemon, Silence, CyberArk, Cloudflare, IBM, Guardian, Bluecoat. You are all listed as cybersecurity partners of this group, which is apparently incorporated in the Marshall Islands, which is soliciting for Bitcoins for its IPO, right? And they're promising a 75% reduction in cybersecurity costs to customers. And like, it just seems, I'm just stunned to see this pop up here, and I'll be very surprised if this domain is still around in a few days.
Yeah, one would certainly hope it would go. I did a little bit of digging into the domain name and the companies behind it, and it immediately turns into a sort of a rat's nest of unrelated companies with acronyms for names. And yeah, what a straight up scam. The LinkedIn profiles for the executives are like, recently created and have, you know, employment histories that are implausible. I think Cisco, IBM, Juniper, I think, was in the list of previous employers of the putative CEO of this company. So, yeah, I think there's a few people that can make this go away.
Yes, indeed. And before we push off, Adam, someone just drew my attention to the Apple bulletin, which talks about the security content of iOS 11. And one thing that I thought was pretty cool, which I didn't know, is like five of those pretty serious bugs that they patched in iOS 11 came from ASD, the Australian Signals Directorate, you know, via the ACSC. So I just wanted to say well done to you at ASD for finding those bugs, those sweet, sweet bugs.
There are some sweet bugs, actually, like the full list of things they fix in iOS 11. There's a lot of doozies in there. One of the ASD bugs is parsing a maliciously crafted font file leads to arbitrary code exec, which, yeah, that's a pretty sweet bug.
What do you think this is, Windows?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
But no, there's all like local privacy and all sorts of really good stuff. So, yeah, I mean, if you haven't patched your phone to iOS 11, you're probably going to want to do that. And if you work at a place like the ASD that's sitting on loads more sweet iOS bugs, then good for you.
Yes, indeed. All right, Adam, that is it for the week's news. Now I'm taking next week off, and I believe you're going to be tied up at an event. So I'll chat to you again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm off. I'm going to talk at B-Sides Wellington, which is a hacker conference running here in New Zealand, somewhat taking the place of KiwiCon, as we chose not to run it this year. But yeah, I'll be away. And then a couple of weeks from now, we'll come back and, you know, I'm sure everything will be terrible and awful and we can talk about it. What fun.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Just some housekeeping now. We have just launched an announcements advertising product here on the Risky Business Podcast. If you want a quick announcement read out at this point in the weekly show, email sales@risky.biz for some more information. Now, that could be a job ad, a product announcement, whatever. But just so you know, I get control of the copy so I don't wind up sounding like a marketing brochure. It's a new thing we're trying and we think it's going to work out pretty well. It's just, you know, for some organizations, it'll just be a way to communicate something simple to the 18,000 or so security people who listen to this show every week. As for next year, the weekly show, as I'm sure you all know, is sold out until 2019. We have 3 soapbox editions of the show left for the whole year. We've sold 7 of those already. The June Snake Oilers edition is full, but there are 2 slots left in March. So yeah, do get in touch if you're interested in pitching your product to the Risky Business audience. Okay, moving on. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Mara Tam. Back at RSA this year, Microsoft's chief legal officer and president, Brad Smith, spoke about the need for a so-called Digital Geneva Convention, the idea being that states shouldn't interfere with, you know, technology and the cybers and all of that sort of stuff. It was a pretty hand-wavy appeal, you know, something, something, North Korea, Sony, something, something, we need a Geneva Convention for the cybers. Our friend and Risky Business sponsor, Haroon Mir of Thinkst, kicked off another round of discussion on this with a recent blog post about the same sort of thing. Haroon is keen for consensus on cyber norms and, you know, for that consensus to be made somehow official so that state interference in software companies' affairs is seen as a no-go zone. Now, that's fair enough, but our next guest, who wrote a rebuttal to Haroon's piece that, to his credit, he ran on his own blog, says that such an agreement just won't be workable and is kind of pointless. Countries like Russia, which is, you know, if we're going to name a bad actor at the moment, that would be it. Well, our guest argues that countries like Russia don't seem to care much about international law. Just look at what they've been up to in Crimea, Georgia, and Ukraine over the last decade. Now, with a few notable exceptions, the Yanks do seem to care, she says. Besides, it's not like a lack of international treaties on good cyber norms is the only way to penalise misbehaving countries. Russia is facing sanctions over its US election meddling, and the 2015 agreement between China and the United States, I don't think that agreement would have been possible without some pretty balanced carrot stick action from US diplomats. So, yeah, sure, most countries don't have the bargaining power of America, but, you know, most consumer and business software and services are from America. So the TLDR becomes, why are we speaking about a Geneva Convention for the cybers? What's the point? Mara Tam joins me now to discuss this. She said I could make up her title, so from today, she's the Risky.biz Global Director of Cyber Policy. And here's what she had to say.
I think for a long time, at least some sectors of the information security community have had this idea that the internet was a space without borders. And, you know, frankly, once this lovely borderless space called the internet became de facto managed by a series of private companies, those private companies all are domiciled within nation states and therefore have nationality. The services are exactly the same. So the idea that you can bypass or circumvent the geopolitical concerns of nation states just because you're online, I think we need to kill that myth dead. Nation states, as it turns out, are still quite relevant.
Yeah.
And the question of whether or not products can be trusted is, I think, a really interesting one, particularly that subset of security products which require extraordinary access, namely antivirus products, which, you know, basically demand ring zero in order to function.
We're also talking not just about sort of antivirus software. We're talking, in the case of the United States, we're talking about the operating systems themselves. They don't have ring zero access. They are ring zero.
Sure. And but I would also say that, you know, losing sleep over whether or not the United States is willing to burn Microsoft is somewhat akin to speculating on about the 400-pound hacker, right? Like, yeah, it could happen.
Well, we've seen evidence too that the United States, well, Five Eyes at least, you know, multiple agencies in this case, were reluctant to attempt that. And I'm speaking specifically about the MD5 collision that those groups used to dummy up a fake, you know, a forged Windows update that could be delivered via an intercept network connection, which did not involve compromising or relying on Microsoft update infrastructure. They faked an update. They didn't compel one. Versus the MEDOC example in Ukraine, you know, where everyone got their tax software hosed. Pretty different examples, right?
Yeah, and I think it's important to highlight the differences between the two cases that we've seen, right? So leaving MEDOC's abysmal initial security posture aside, you know, one of the points that I tried to get across in the post that I wrote for Thinkst was that we're really not comparing like to like when we compare the United States to Russia, right? If the Russian government wants to compel something, they will compel it. There is no public showdown. There is no Apple versus FBI. You do it or your company is expropriated. You maybe come to physical harm, but there are severe consequences for noncompliance. In the United States, you can have that public showdown.
Can you in the case of things like national security letters?
I would say that the Apple versus FBI case argues to the affirmative that you can vigorously resist, maybe not publicly, but you can vigorously resist requests without negative consequences to your operations or your safety, which is not the case in Russia.
Could you just explain to us why a Geneva Convention for software is basically a shitty idea?
First, it, I think, misunderstands what the Geneva Convention or conventions more properly actually are. And second, I think it's a feel-good and sort of thought-leadery way of passing the buck back to an assemblage of governments that very rarely agree on binding standards of conduct for anything. It's a nice sounding idea, but at this moment in time, it is utterly impracticable.
It's interesting too, because in your blog post, you actually pointed out some history that I was completely unaware of. The funny part, I thought, was when Russia was proposing some norms in this space and the US was pretty keen to shut that down.
Yeah, so this is, I find the diplomatic history here just fascinating, because Russia was the one that initiated this dialogue back in late 1998. And if you think about where Russia was at the time versus where the United States was at the time, we were demonstrating, I think, quite worrying applications of information and telecommunications technologies to our conventional weapons forces in the Balkans. This is long-range precision strike at volume. And if you're Russia in late 1998, you're lurching through your second major currency crisis in less than a decade. You are in the middle of the wild 90s, a decade that Russia has since disavowed entirely. Yeltsin on New Year's Eve 1999 apologized to the nation for their misadventures with capitalism and liberal democracy. So at this moment, Russia approaches the UN and proposes some pretty interesting and ambitious norms for behavior of states in this area. And, you know, frankly, they proposed norms that would have contraindicated their entire current cyber doctrine. They talk about preventing the threat of the use of information technologies and means to influence social consciousness with a view to destabilizing a society and state.
That's interesting. and funnily enough, it was the United States that said, nah, we're not interested in that.
Yeah, we had no interest in this for about 8 years. So we responded early in this process to the effect that, well, there are other international processes taking place. The Budapest Convention on Cybercrime looked pretty promising. And our representatives in this issue came back with a response to the effect that, you know, we should wait and see how these other multilateral efforts pan out. And it would be premature and possibly damaging to try to do something at the United Nations while those efforts are still ongoing.
Do you think that was a sincere response, though? Do you think that was the United States actually stating what it believed in its heart, or do you think they were being a bit sneaky?
So it's difficult to judge sincerity on both sides. On the Russian side, I do think it is possible that there was a plurality of political opinion that was genuinely terrified about getting into another arms race. On the other hand, you know, barring some pretty egregious examples to the contrary, the United States tends to be relatively Boy Scoutish when it comes to interpretations of international law. The United States tends to aim for unambiguously legal, not legal under scrutiny. And Russia.
Now you mentioned that to me. You mentioned that to me when we were in planning for this interview, and I found that fine. Look, I mean, you know, I've observed the behavior of the United States throughout my career, and I you know, everything that happens tends to go through stages of legal review. But I can understand how a lot of listeners might find it difficult to swallow that, given the 2003 Iraq War. I mean, how do we support that statement that the United States errs on the side of caution when it comes to international law, when, you know, it invaded a country in a way that most people, you know, many, many credible people argue was illegal?
Yeah, I certainly, like I said, there are egregious examples to the contrary in the form of manufacturing casus belli in the case of the Iraq War. My favorite case is arming the Contras in Nicaragua. The International Court of Justice case there is fascinating because they found that, yes, arming and training the Contras was indeed a violation of Nicaragua's sovereignty, and it constituted interference in their internal affairs. Strangely enough, propagandizing them and inciting them to commit actions in direct violation of international humanitarian law. Any such actions taken by the Contras were not imputable as acts of the United States. So propagandizing didn't meet the same bar. Arming and training the Contras was found to be highly problematic from an international law perspective. Propagandizing the Contras to violate international humanitarian law, however, was not found to be as legally problematic. I find this fascinating because in the years since, Russia and China have adopted a position that interference in their internal affairs, their concept of interference in their internal affairs, is a much lower bar than what was established in Nicaragua versus United States. In Nicaragua versus US, propagandizing an armed group didn't meet that bar. But for Russia and China, everything is interference in their internal affairs.
So this brings me to another part of this conversation, which is, you know, we all talk about how we want to establish norms. Now, it seems to me that norms, there's two ways that they can be established. They can be established through law, and there's some international law which isn't nearly as comprehensive as people seem to think it is. But generally speaking, norms are just that, right? I mean, most norms are sort of seem to me to be informal, especially when it comes to actions on the internet.
Right. Norms are called that for a reason. And international law, and one of the reasons why I get particularly crunchy about Brad Smith's position at Microsoft, is that he's attempting to basically circumvent the normal formation of international law, which is that it flows from the customary behavior and law of states. It is really, really difficult to achieve consensus around international law and binding standards in a forum like the UN if there's no agreement whatsoever in the customary law of states on the issue in question.
Yeah, and it sort of gets to the point too, where say there was some sort of United Nations guidance or rules around how this stuff should work, would it really stop a country like Russia or a country like China or a country even like the United States, if push came to shove, from engaging in activities that were contrary to that charter when, you know, as you just pointed out, they had no problem arming the Contras in Nicaragua. They had no problem invading Iraq in 2003. And that was, you know, these are instances where there is clear law that says you shouldn't do those things. So I sort of wonder what the point of it would be.
So I would come back again to the point that the United States, the examples where the United States has acted in direct violation of international law, or it is strongly hinted that they have acted in violation of international law, that tends to be exceptional rather than the rule. Now, on the flip side, the United States has a very strong legalistic culture. There are departures from that culture which are lamentable, but the trend is still towards that legalistic school. Now, on the Russian side, the more or less the opposite is true. This is why I say it's difficult to judge sincerity on both sides, because the Russian overture may have been calculated to take advantage of the fact that the United States tends towards much stricter readings of international law than Russia ever has, and exploiting the fact that that the United States is more likely to hew to the inside of the legal framework and not push it. It basically means that if there is a binding agreement, it's going to hurt the United States more than it hurts Russia, just because of the way that they approach these things.
Mm. But I mean, this sort of, I mean, I guess the point that I was trying to get at was that, I sort of wanted to talk about the idea of consequences, right? And if you're talking about, say there was some violations involved in some international agreement when it comes to, say, Russia's actions against the DNC, for example, would that really matter? I mean, you know, it just seems to me that, and I'm not saying there's no point having laws that are going to be broken, right? I mean, if it was as simple as that, we wouldn't have a law against murder, for example. But at the same time, there's some pretty clear consequences for murdering someone in every jurisdiction in the world. Whereas when you look at stuff like this, I'm thinking, what are the consequences to me as a state that wants to perform these actions, even if there is a UN agreement in place? You usually, the countries acting out in the worst ways are usually countries that are in enough trouble with the global community already. So I just sort of wonder how far it would get you.
That's a really good question. The issue of consequences for violations of international law is, like we were discussing, the United States was found to have violated international law on a number of counts in Nicaragua versus US, which I think is 1986 ICJ 14. and nothing really happened. I mean, the ICJ, I think at one point, had was looking at reparations. But again, like, there ultimately were not really any consequences. In the case of, say, information and telecommunications technologies in the context of international security, it's even less clear what consequences there would be for violating even a binding arrangement there. Now, an interesting debate that came up at SciCon US last week was around whether it is preferable to expand the universe of international humanitarian law and the law of armed conflict so that it encompasses all of these digital domain operations, or if it's preferable to keep them what they called sub-LOAC, or below the threshold of the law of armed conflict. And there's actually, I think, a really good argument for the second model, because if you're the United States, or if you're any nuclear or strongly conventionally armed state, you really don't want everything to be within the realm of, to be above that LOAC threshold, because the potential for escalation is frankly terrifying. And you want to keep the threshold for the application of the law of armed conflict to be quite high, because once you get into that space, the consequences of escalation can be catastrophic.
Well, and let's not forget, too, that, you know, even though there is no United Nations agreement on this stuff, it has not stopped the United States putting sanctions on Russia over its meddling in elections. So there are consequences that can be delivered to bad actors regardless of international law. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But a lot of people who write about this...
That is a really good point. And to that second model where you keep digital domain activities sub-LOAC, that doesn't mean that you can't respond. You know, it's not like you're tying your hands, so to speak. You absolutely can engage in response.
Well, Mara Tam, thank you very much for joining us on the show to talk through all of this stuff. I think we are some way off a Geneva Convention for software, personally, but yeah, it's been fun to talk about it. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Pat.
That was Mara Tam there. Big thanks to her for that. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this week's show is brought to you by Duo Security. Duo is known as a company that sells multi-factor authentication software. But really, they're more than that. They're sort of aiming to become, you know, more like an authentication platform that doesn't just verify the users, but verifies the health of the device that the user is on as well. So Duo's research arm, Duo Labs, is spending a lot of time these days looking into device security, all sorts of devices. Rich Smith and Papine Brienne of Duo Labs decided to look at Mac firmware updates, EFI updates, to see how effective they were. And what they found was that EFI updates don't always stick, and the results of that research were pretty uneven, which was a surprise, I guess, because, you know, Apple controls the whole stack from the hardware to the OS, and it was still a bit of a mess. So Rich Smith, the R&D director at Duo Labs, joined me to have a bit of a chat about that research, and here he is.
I guess the purpose of the research was part of a larger body of work that we're doing just to get better insight into current capabilities of lower-level security hardware in consumer-grade platforms, and as well as looking at where things are going in the future. So seeing how those platforms are evolving, new capabilities that are coming out in Intel's chips. Obviously, recent TouchBar Macs have shipped with essentially a SEP, a coprocessor in there. YubiKeys are obviously continuing to progress in the capabilities that they have. TPMs have been around for a while, but are now actually starting to get some widespread use and adoption. So the EFI research really began as part of our more general hardware exploration.
So it was really about, you know, sort of diving into the weeds and having a bit of a look around.
Yeah, you know, and I think we had some hypotheses that we started the work with and we wanted to explore. So you start to pull on that thread, and the nice thing about research is you don't necessarily know where it's going to lead. That's why I find it exciting, and start to pull on that thread, and there were definitely some areas of EFI that looked very interesting as we start to gather our data. You know, there was a lot more opportunities to dig in, and you know, the analysis revealed what I think are some pretty interesting findings. So we were pleased with how it went overall, but it would be a lie to say we planned it all from the start.
We've spoken about this research on the show before, and Adam and I both assumed incorrectly that you were able to figure all this out by looking at data collected via Duo products, because you do integrity checking on hosts that are trying to authenticate, right? That's part of what Duo does. But that's actually wrong, right? Like, you actually did this as completely standalone research, completely separated from Duo products.
So yeah, neither of the two data sets that we worked with were data sets that Duo already had. So the work was really in two phases. The first one was the analysis of all of the updates that Apple had released really over the last 3 years. So we did the analysis of all of those OS updates and security updates that Apple had shipped, and we yanked out all of the EFI firmware updates that they contained. And then from that, we were able to build up a large data set where we had a mapping between the hardware model, specific hardware model board ID of the MacBooks or the Apple gear, and the OS version, the build version of that OS, and the particular EFI version that model and that version of the OS should have applied during the update. And so we built out those triplicates into a large data set, and that was all just based off stuff that Apple had released. The second phase of the work was to compare that idealized world data set that we built up from Apple updates to data that we were gathering from real world systems. And as you said, we didn't have this data in our data sets that we had from Duo authentications. So we actually reached out to a number of, you know, friends, family, organizations that we work well with, and asked them to supply us with three version strings really off their large Mac fleets. So again, that was the build number of the OS that was running, the specific hardware model, and then the version of the EFI that was running. And we built up a similar data set, and then we kind of collided those two data sets and we looked for discrepancies.
And discrepancies you found. And what I'm really wondering, right, is if you're capable of doing a very, you know, running a very straightforward process to determine that these numbers are not where they should be, you know, you're comparing an EFI version to a hardware version, you're looking at a date, you're looking at an OS, an OS version, you're saying, well, this isn't where it should be. It begs the question, if it's so easy to read that information, why were these Apple patches not sticking?
Yeah, and I think this data set, or these data sets that we built up, allow us to see very well what was happening. It's much more difficult for us to say why.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had some guesses, and we had some, you know, intuition, but the only people that are really able to say concretely why are Apple themselves. And, you know, the data that we would require for that is data that is difficult or impossible for us to get. So we could see the what, but it was very difficult for us to 100% accurately determine the why. We could have some educated guesses, which we did in the paper.
And walk us through a couple of them.
So I think the interesting thing about this research and what made the analysis quite succinct was that there is this strong mapping between the version of the OS and the version of the EFI for a particular piece of hardware. Now, Apple is the only platform that really we can do that on scale, because they control the whole stack. They control kind of, you know, hardware, firmware, software, and in a change around 2015 that we wholeheartedly support, they stopped making users update their firmware separately than their OS. You know, it's very, very easy for people to not update their firmware if it requires lots of extra steps. And this is what you see in the Wintel world. You know, you either have to go to the motherboard manufacturer or maybe the laptop OEM, the device manufacturer there, and get a separate set of updates. Microsoft is not in a position to be pushing out EFI updates for all those different combinations of hardware that run Windows. You know, Apple's in a very nice position that it is able to do that because it controls the whole stack. So they were able to, you know, keep the firmware update in the same way that they were keeping the software updated, which is great, and something that we support. The discrepancies of why the particular versions of of systems were not running the expected versions of EFI definitely raised questions. So from everything that we looked into when we were researching the update process and how EFI was reflashed in modern Mac devices, it really is a one shot. So if during that update process something goes wrong for whatever reason, the user isn't notified that the expected EFI is now not running, that EFI update process broke, and there's no way to kind of retry that, say, at the next reboot.
So they're setting a flag somewhere a little bit too early.
I think, they have the attempt of updating the EFI, and if that doesn't work for some reason, and, there could be lots of reasons that doesn't work, then you don't really get another crack at that until you do your next security update or OS update. There are certainly mechanisms of fleet management that people could use that deliberately don't update those EFI parts and just update the OS. And some of the golden image processes that people use to configure and manage their Mac fleets may inadvertently just leave out the EFI updates. So some of this may be a problem on Apple's side, where there's an issue with the EFI update process, and once it fails, there's no notification, and it kind of fails silently. And some of this could definitely be on the administrator's side, who decided to update their fleets in a way which negated to include EFI updates.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, you just pointed out, though, it's kind of funny we're having this conversation and criticism of Apple about some of their patches not sticking, where in the Wintel world, it's borderline impossible to try to do that to a fleet of computers of any real scale, right?
Yeah, correct. And I think this is like a really important thing that we tried our best to point out during the research, which was we were lazy researchers. We chose to use the Apple data set because it was easiest for us. And it was easiest for us because they do control that whole stack.
Yeah. So, but when you're entering a world of 200 different motherboard manufacturers and,
Exactly. So, that would have made our analysis much more complicated. It's not impossible, but it's just harder.
But I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is the logical conclusion is that the problem in the Wintel world would be much, much worse.
Absolutely. And we actually believe that Apple is doing some of the best work, if not the best work, in terms of firmware updating and how seriously that they approach their EFI security. I mean, some of the folks that they've hired into their EFI and kind of firmware security teams are the best in the world at this kind of stuff. So they clearly see the value and are taking it very seriously. So we tried our best to explain that this is the data that we had gathered was specific to Apple, but we felt was indicative of an industry-wide issue. Mm. And actually, in the industry, we feel Apple are doing the best job. So we definitely wanted to let people know about the issues that we had found, but I don't think there's any reason for Apple to be overly demonized for this, because it really is an industry-wide issue.
Yeah.
And if you looked on that Wintel side, story would be much, much, much worse.
Yeah, yeah, it would be absolutely hideous, but even trying to do the research would be prohibitively difficult. It would be a little bit more time-consuming. Now, one thing that you mentioned to me before we hit the record button is that you can actually retrieve EFI version information via OS query. Now, of course, a trojaned or malicious EFI version can tell you it's whatever version number it wants to tell you. But I mean, at least this way, you might be able to get a handle on how much of an issue it is for you. I'm guessing that OS query capability would work across all platforms, really. I mean, that's kind of the point of OS query, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's a number of those management tools that, just everyday people are using, Chef, Puppet, OS query. You can even just do kind of, a straight up shell command to pull out the relevant details that you need to be able to determine, are you running the expected version of EFI? And we detail those in the paper. So it's very easy to get this information. But like you say, the important thing to realize is this work is not looking for malicious EFI that's trying to tell you the wrong version. That's not the focus of the work. It was much more around, are those EFI update processes or firmware update processes in general working the way that we would expect and have come to expect of software update processes? And, are the security, the diligence of security updates that are being applied to firmware on a level with those that are being applied to software? So
yeah,
it's pretty easy to get those versions out, and you can use a number of different tools to do that. And we built out the tool that we've called Effigy, that's an API, so that once you've got those versions, you can essentially query our API, and that will tell you, are you running the expected version of EFI, or, you know, a different version, or, you know, some other concerns that particular versions of EFI may carry with them.
I'm presuming that's Apple only, right?
Yes. Yeah. Because our data set is currently Apple only, the Effigy stuff is really only relevant to Apple. Yeah.
Now, I'm imagining too, Rich, that the reason you want to raise awareness of this is as more and more sort of crypto magic processes get baked into standard hardware, the idea that EFI is going to be updated properly is going to get more and more critical as we move to place a lot of trust in these subsystems. Is that right?
I think so. I think, you know, EFI is definitely a critical subsystem. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, there's crypto processors kind of starting to find their way into more and more systems. You know, the new MacBooks are definitely essentially two computers in the same box with the Touch Bar and the T1 SEP in there. And that's a trend that I would expect we will continue to see. That it's almost, you know, over the next few years, we're going to be getting to, you know, a network of devices in a box. Still looks like a laptop, still acts like a laptop, but may have, you know, a number of different independent subsystems in them. And that means that, you know, you have to treat each of them, you know, like its own mini computer.
And the EFI sort of glues them together in a way, doesn't it?
It can. The EFI really is the best analogy for EFI that we kind of use to help explain things is it's really the starter motor to the system. You know, it does a lot of the things to get the ball rolling and hand over control to OS to then do a full boot of the system and get you to a graphical desktop. You know, those other co-processors that may be sitting in the system may be recognized by EFI, maybe interface with EFI, or maybe they don't really get interface until the full OS is up and running. Definitely, you know, devil is in the details there.
Yeah, okay.
But the bigger takeaway, I think, is that you know, as there's more of these independent systems and, you know, kind of field upgradable firmware out there, they all need to be treated in the same way that we are treating software updates in terms of security. I think we've got pretty good at, you know, people following the mantra of, you know, kind of keep your software up to date and you're going to be, you know, you're going to be in a pretty good spot. We need to be doing the same with firmware, whether that's EFI, whether that's, you know, kind of your USB-C controller, whatever it may be. Lots of these systems can have issues, and lots of them are field upgradable. We just need to make sure that those patches are getting applied and people are applying as much due diligence to their firmware security and versions as they do to their software.
Yeah, lest someone else start inserting new features in your EFI.
Exactly, you know, certainly yeah. EFI can undermine the security of everything at the higher layers of the stack.
All right, Rich Smith, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to walk us through that research. It's been very interesting.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Patrick.
That was Rich Smith there. I have linked through to Duo's research. Go check that out in this week's show notes. But yeah, that is it for me. I'll be back in 2 weeks. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.